Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Before we continue with our drive towards a sustainable world, let's take another quick moment to reflect on the dying path of fossil fuel destruction. Perhaps you've heard that Calgary, the oil capital of Canada, was more or less shut down by flash flooding and overflowing rivers. As fate would have it, I was in Calgary on the night of Wednesday, June 19th, as the black skies filled with thunder for almost a dozen hours. Sheets of rain, torrents of rain, more than I've seen, drenched the city. All the foothills let loose, creeks became rivers, rivers became fast-running lakes, filling the streets, the homes, entire neighborhoods, and towns. Fearing the water supply would become contaminated, there was panic buying of bottled water until the shelves ran dry. As always, few were ready for an extreme rainfall event in that dry prairie. Here is a brief clip from the government-supported Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. The program, Current Events, hosted by Anna Maria Tremonti. It's possibly the only report from a climate scientist in those days of nonstop coverage of the Alberta floods. The speaker is Robert Sandford, the EPCOR chair supporting the United Nations Water for Life decade.
Well, to scientists working in the domain of climate effects on water, this is really the worst of all possible outcomes. We built in floodplains because we thought we had relatively stable climate, the climate that we've experienced over the past century. We thought it would stay the same. We also thought that we had a good grasp of how variable we could expect climatic conditions to be based on what we've experienced in the past century. And now we've discovered that neither assumption was correct. We do not have adequate means to protect development in floodplains. Climatic conditions are more variable than we thought, and that variability is increasing as climate changes. And we've also discovered that our hydrologic conditions are changing.
So what do floods like this tell us about what's happening with our water cycles?
Well, if we put all of the data together, they tell us that warming temperatures are altering the form that water takes and where it goes in the hydrosphere. Evidence that increasing temperatures are accelerating the manner and rate at which water is moving through the hydrological cycle is now widely enough available to allow us to connect the dots with respect to what's happening in Canada. So let's start very briefly in the Canadian Arctic. In the north and throughout much of the Canadian boreal, water that's been trapped as ice in the form of glaciers and as permanent snowpack and permafrost is in decline. And the same sort of thing is visibly evident in Canada's western mountains. There's now evidence that we've lost as many as 300 glaciers in the Canadian Rockies alone between 1920 and 2005. And the same thing that's causing our glaciers to disappear is in combination with landscape change, changing precipitation patterns on the Great Plains. And the same warming is causing water left on the land after the last glaciation in the Great Lakes region to evaporate. So you might ask, well, where's all this water going? And one of the places it's going is into the atmosphere, where it becomes available to fuel more frequent and intense extreme weather events, such as the one that you had in Toronto in 2005 that caused $700 million worth of flood damage to infrastructure, roads, and homes. And you may remember that in that year, Calgary just dodged the same kind of bullet. Well, not this time. And what we're seeing here is that rising temperatures and the increasing concentration of atmospheric vapor are making what were once predictable natural events much worse. And what we've discovered is the atmosphere holds about 7% more water vapor for each temperature degree Celsius temperature increase. And what this tells us is the old math and the old methods of flood prediction and protection won't work anymore. And until we find a new way of substantiating appropriate action in the absence of this hydrologic stability, flood risks are going to be increasingly difficult to predict or to price, not just in Calgary or Canmore, but everywhere.
So you're saying then that there's more condensation in the air. Warm air can hang on to water longer and then burst when it hits somewhere that can no longer hang on to it?
Well, warmer atmosphere is more turbulent and it carries more water vapor, and we're seeing that happening widely. We're also seeing in North America a disruption in the jet stream, which is allowing climatic events to cluster and remain in places for longer periods of time, resulting in more intense and floods and droughts. And we're seeing this as a result of a general warming in the atmosphere.
That was Robert Sanford on CBC explaining the science behind extreme rainfall events due to climate change. Even he did not have the courage to suggest we must reduce our emissions of fossil fuels as a solution. He spoke instead of adapting to wilder climate swings. Enough. The same madness of denial goes on all over the world. In my opinion, all you and I can do as individuals who know that physics and nature will not be denied is to keep pushing the movement towards a sane, sustainable society. We're about to talk to an optimist driven by a vision that it can be done. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're at the Mother Earth News Fair with Brian Welch, who runs Ogden Publications, and it's the publisher of Mother Earth News and many other very interesting publications, some of which I'm sure you read. It's really a pleasure to welcome you, Brian, to our mobile studio here.
Thanks, Alex.
You know, the last time we talked, it was about your book, Beautiful and Abundant, Building the World We Want. And we didn't really come to an agreement because at the time I was feeling pretty pessimistic about our chances for a lot of reasons, the economy, the environment, we could go on. Now, a year later, I'm having a rethink. You know, I think it was the word abundance that stuck me. As I told you, I think it brought up this picture of more shoes in the closet, but there's more to it than that, isn't there?
Well, of course. I mean, abundance basically means having more of some resource than you absolutely need for survival. And it seems to me that's an important part of the resilience of any biological system, is that there's abundance in it, that there are more resources available than are necessary for the perpetuity of that system. Also, you know, it's our job at Mother Earth News and at Mother Earth Living and the other things we do, we feel like it's our job to broaden the audience, to bring the conversation about sustainability and about conservation to larger groups of people. And we've just found that talking about austerity and speaking constantly in terms of withholding resources from people makes it hard to begin that conversation. It's not that people aren't frugal or aren't willing to sacrifice or aren't willing to put up with a different kind of prosperity that doesn't consume as many resources. They're up for all of that. It's just that constantly couching the argument in terms of what people need to give up makes it hard for us to broaden the audience. And we think broadening the audience is a really important part of our mission.
Right. And I think, too, what our grandparents and great-grandparents might have seen as abundance has a different aspect to it, too. It's whether the table was full at Thanksgiving, whether the families were full. There's all sorts of things that we can have in abundance that don't have to bring the planet down with it.
For sure. I mean, abundance is dictated. I mean, the concept of abundance is based upon levels of consumption. You know, if we're moderate in our consumption, if we live simple lives, then abundance is much more easily achieved than it is if we are extremely consumptive and running around burning and eating and pillaging everything, pillaging nature, as it were. So, yeah, I mean, a modest, simple lifestyle makes abundance more accessible than it is if we don't live a modest, simple lifestyle. I mean, the other underlying quantitative condition on all this is human population, of course. You know, there are, what, over 7 billion people on the planet now. That's double what it was when I was born. It's a rate of population expansion that's completely unsustainable, and it's quite obvious, I think, to anyone who observes nature, anybody who works in agriculture as I do. It's perfectly obvious to everyone that we're going to have to stabilize the human population. If we're going to have to stabilize it, why not talk in terms of a truly sustainable human population? That is, a smaller population than is currently on the planet, a population that allows for ongoing abundance, natural resilience, the possibility of prosperity for all human beings, and the possibility of healthy, natural lifestyles for all forms of creatures. The only quantity in the equation necessary to achieve that goal that we refuse to talk seriously about is the human population. But in a world of 3 billion people, you know, it's possible. I don't think it's desirable, but it's possible everybody could drive an SUV.
Yes, except we can't do it with fossil fuels unless we come up with an answer for that. Now, we're electric vehicles, I suppose, solar-powered vehicles, we could do that. And that leads me to my next point, which is talking about beauty. That's part of the title. I stopped at North Bend on the way over here through Snoqualmie Pass. It's part of Washington State.
Yeah, I've been there.
Have you?
Place, yeah.
Yeah. Well, there's this truck world there, and there was at least 500, maybe 1,000, I couldn't count them all, trucks all lined up, one, waiting to eat at their fast food restaurants. And I thought, okay, now this is the backbone behind a lot of the lives that we live that we never see. And there are other places that we never see, whether it's the tar sands or whether it's radioactive waste from nuclear plants. If we're going to have beauty, I think it has to be beautiful all through the process. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I certainly completely agree with your premise. I think that we should hold beauty as a standard for every activity we're in. I don't know that you can't extract fossil fuels in a beautiful way. I think you probably can. You know, levels of consumption are the backdrop for all of this. And of course, there are infinite numbers of ways that we could fuel transportation. We could generate electricity and store it in batteries. We could burn wood and create a gas from the burning of wood that could be combusted in engines. I mean, the list goes on and on. There are literally infinite ways of producing energy. The underlying question, though, is I think a question of values. If we hold beauty and abundance and fairness as fundamental values that we want to adhere to, it changes the way we make decisions about how we generate energy and how much of it we consume. It changes our decisions about how we run our businesses and where we get the raw materials and how we treat the people who supply those raw materials, how we treat the people who work for us. And I think that leads us in a direction toward a new set of human values that's more sustainable. I think that industrial society is really kind of a juvenile society. That's my fundamental belief, that industrial society is young and that it doesn't have grown-up values. And that, you know, traditional laissez-faire capitalists feel like capitalism has to work with no human intent involved at all. It has to function simply by the desire of people to become more prosperous, the availability of cheap natural resources which we can exploit, the availability of new natural resources which we can discover and exploit in inexpensive ways. It's the sort of very, what would one say, simplistic model. In the future, I think that really doesn't work at all, and that, in fact, value will have to be created through conscientiousness, through a mindful approach to businesses of all kinds, including the production and consumption of all forms of energy. And in that value system, the kind of wholesale environmental damage that's occurred in pursuit of fossil fuels just won't be palatable. People won't wish to consume fuels that are extracted in that kind of exploitative way. I think we're on our way to that new value system.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. I'm with Brian Welch of Ogden Publications. And you talk about the Mother Earth News Fair community. Well, the Mother Earth News community. And you have a vision for that. I don't think you're doing this just for the money, Brian. I think you're doing this for some reasons. What is motivating you?
Wow. Fundamentally, I think I'm motivated in the way maybe most people are motivated. I really want to leave a better world behind. I really want to find ways of improving the world I live in. I think most people are motivated that way. You know, Alex, this may surprise you. Well, part of this may surprise you. So we're studied by big research agencies because we're a big enough magazine. The big advertisers want to know who our readers are. And these big syndicated research agencies, the most prominent one's called MRI. MRI measures all kinds of facets of our readers, including their political persuasion. And the Mother Earth News reader is about 95% more likely than the average American to describe themselves as very liberal. And they are 85% more likely than the average American to describe themselves as very conservative. Furthermore, because there's so many more self-described conservatives in North America than there are liberals, we have about three times as many very conservative people among our readers than we do very liberal people among our readers. Conscientiousness is not partisan. And one of the grand errors, one of the biggest mistakes made by the conservation movement all this time, has been to focus their energies on quote-unquote political liberals and to ignore the deep conscientiousness of political conservatives. And we try to open up the dialogue to people of every political persuasion by eliminating the tribal language and the partisan language from what we talk about, and just talk about in terms of what a person can do in their own lives to make the world a better place. We find huge audiences at both ends of the political spectrum for that particular message. And I find, you know, you asked about my own motivation, I find that deeply gratifying.
Well, conservation did begin, I would say, in America at least. Well, one of its roots is with Theodore Roosevelt, who made the great parks. And there have been conservatives who want to conserve.
Seems logical, doesn't it?
It does. So what's next for you? Are you going to do presentations at the show?
I'm giving a couple of talks. I just contributed, I'm going to talk about my own thinking. I'm working on a book which I'm tentatively calling Heroic Compassion, about the need for human mortality to create a sustainable world. I'm pointing out to people these days that if we cured cancer tomorrow, that we would have to start building another New York City every year to accommodate all the human beings that weren't dying of cancer that year, just to sort of put a real stamp on it. And when I was reading something about human lifespans expanding dramatically over the next few decades, and there's good scientific evidence that that's going to occur. But it struck me as obvious then that eventually we have to choose between something like immortality and reproduction. You can't have both. You can't have everybody living forever and reproducing biologically, right? And when I thought about it in that way, it occurred to me, well, if I had a choice between those two things, I would obviously choose to reproduce and to die. And once I made that conscious choice, it sort of liberated my mind. It made me a happier person. It gave me a whole new sense of a kind of heroic aspect to mortality. The sacrifice, the natural sacrifice of passing on and leaving room, not just for other people, but for all kinds of other living things. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that when I stand up on the stage tomorrow. And I'm going to join a panel discussion with my friends Lyle Estel and Albert Bates about a book we've all contributed to that's coming out here in the next few months.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own home life in Topeka, Kansas, I believe it is?
Yeah, I live just outside of Lawrence, Kansas, on a 50-acre farm where my wife and I raise cattle and sheep and goats. We have a bunch of chickens and keep sheepdogs and a few other animals. We have donkeys who protect our sheep and goats from predators. And both of us have other careers besides the farming, and so that's sort of our avocation. My daily life, you know, I write in the morning, I go to the office during the day, and I come home and farm in the evening, usually.
Sounds like a busy life for sure. One other aspect I wanted to ask you about was, there are a great number of Americans now who feel like they're falling in their standards of living, and there are some who are just plain poor. There are millions of poor. There are millions of people on food stamps. And I could see a lot of solutions for those people in the Mother Earth News. There's a lot of things that you can do there cheap, that you can do with recycled materials, that you can do for yourself. Do you feel that that audience is also part of your readership and your mandate, if you want to say?
For sure. For sure. Well, there's a great American tradition of improving our standards of living through self-reliance. If you can make something for yourself, then you can afford a better thing. You know, you can raise your own standard of living through just your own bootstraps and your own energy level. And that's a big part of the history of Mother Earth News. It's been a part of our message from the very beginning, and it's a real important part of the message. Yeah, I think everybody interested in Mother Earth News is interested in self-reliance, and we find an improvement to our quality of life, not only through the resources that we create, but also through the engagement with doing for ourselves, which makes us healthier and happier and more satisfied on a daily basis, I think.
Right. We don't just want to be witnesses to our own lives and have someone else define, maybe through a corporation or the T-shirt we wear with the name brand or something like that, who we are. We want to define ourselves. And that's partly what you're talking about, building the world we want.
Yes, I think that's very true. Future generations are going to want us to leave that world behind. But furthermore, I think there's a sacred commerce between human beings and nature. We're part of nature, of course, but it's a sacred communion between us and the natural world that produces our food. We're engaged with that communion on a daily basis every time we consume anything. And the more intimately we become involved in that communion, I think the more satisfying it is on a psychological and spiritual level. I think people love creating their own food because it is a sacred communion and because there's something deeply and innately fulfilling about interacting on an intimate level with nature to produce what we eat.
And we talk about green jobs. We're sitting beside a building of green entrepreneurs here at the Mother Earth News Fair.
Yeah.
And just a wide variety of people. And I'm seeing a lot of people with families. And these people aren't fooling around like it's a hobby. There's a living being made here. And it's, I would say, an honest living.
I think capitalism is the most important ally conservation, conscientiousness, progressivism could have. And we make a big mistake when we reject the capitalist machinery as a whole, because the best energy, the best achievements in conservation and in sustainability over the past many decades have been achieved by private business people innovating for the purpose of creating successful, profitable businesses. And Mother Earth News is one of those businesses. Yes, and we're not solely motivated by the profit motive. But one of the ways in which we continue to do good in the world is by continuing to be profitable. And we can do more with the largest media brand about sustainability in the world because we've been consistently profitable and reinvested our profits in the business. And it could not have been achieved, in my opinion, in any other way.
What do you think? I'm seeing in some of the exhibits a longing for an agrarian past. You know, I just feel that when I look at some of the boards are carefully chosen. They're old barn boards, and some of the structures that I see remind me of old American farming. Is the past part of our future?
I think the past is not that far past. I think also that it's the nature of human learning that we keep track of the innovations we wish to retain and those we wish to reject. And I think in every generation there's been change. In every generation has chosen which of those changes it wants to keep and which of those changes it wishes to throw away. So being in touch with the past is very important. It's a meter against which we can measure our current lifestyles. I know that our readers value very deeply the traditional agrarian lifestyle that was lived close to nature, in which people knew exactly the source of their foods and of their livelihoods and understood the mechanisms of those livelihoods and the sources of their food. And so, you know, a lively, vital knowledge of what life was like in our agrarian past is very important to maintaining those critical connections, I think.
Well, and plus, people like Bailey, I believe it was, that wrote about how to grow in the 1910s, 1920s, no toxic pesticides. I mean, it had to be organic, and how to reuse the ashes from your wood stove when you were growing. All these sorts of things are still very useful knowledge now if you want to have clean food and be self-reliant.
And we, at points in history, live truly in harmony with nature in a way that could have persisted for at least until the planet ceased to be a good host for biology. And we're probably not living lives today that are truly sustainable. Modern industrial society is out of balance. I think there's an intuitive understanding that that's true. And so we look for examples of good balance, true sustainability in the past, and we find, I think, some good direction from that. Although I definitely caution people against being too nostalgic. You know, we live today in the least violent, most prosperous times in the history of our species. Fewer innocent people die of violence now than ever before in the history of our species by a significant measure. Fewer people are desperately poor. Fewer people are hungry. Human lifespans are longer. Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Natures, enumerates the evidence that shows all this to be abundantly true. And so I think it's very important to understand what we've gained and the power of the positive visions we've had in the past in order that we don't throw away those gains. But that doesn't mean that everything about modern society is superior to the lifestyles we previously led. So I would caution people about uniformly endorsing this either as the best of times or as the worst of times.
Why do you think so many of us are fearful about the future?
Well, part of that is the news media, which only gains ratings and audience by reporting scary stuff, or not only, but that's certainly the best way. I mean, I was a newspaper publisher for many years, and the car wreck and the frightening headline were always much more compelling to create sales on the newsstand than stories about how good things were. So that's how the news media works, and that's part of it. Part of it may be just neurosis. You know, that people have a hard time acknowledging that they live in a very comfortable, relatively easy time compared with past times because they personally are struggling. And it doesn't make sense to them that life might have been harder for previous generations.
Which it was with the Great Wars and the Great Depression. We just haven't gone through that tens of millions killed in a war during our lifetimes, I don't believe, at least not here in the West.
No, many of our previous chapters were truly horrific, and not that long ago, you know. The life on the North American frontier when Native Americans and Europeans were battling for territory was frightening and grotesque and horrific, and it's not all that long ago. But we tend to romanticize the past, perhaps for neurotic reasons, I'm not sure. So, you know, it's a tricky business, isn't it? Figuring out what we want our future to be like and correctly assessing what we've accomplished without being too self-congratulatory or indulging in hubris. Because, of course, there's a lot in the past that we could adopt today and improve society. And we should look for a future that's more sustainable and more humane and more prosperous than the age in which we live. I tell people that there are fewer poor people than ever. But I don't mean to excuse the fact at all that there are millions upon millions of terribly poor people across the globe. And there shouldn't be. We have the power to create some level of physical comfort and prosperity for everyone. And we should do that at the earliest possible opportunity. But previous generations' positive visions of prosperity and of peace have been realized by our generation. We also need to accept that that achievement has occurred and try to make sure we don't give up the ground we've gained.
That is a beautiful place to end, I think. We've been talking with Brian Welch, and you're with Ogden Publications. Do you own Ogden Publications? Are you CEO? What is
your
relationship?
I'm the chief executive, and it belongs to a group of shareholders. They're all members of one family, not my family, but they've been wonderful and supportive and made it possible for us to do this all these years.
Right. And are you going to keep going with Mother Earth News Fairs? Is that just to...
I believe we'll have more every year for the next several years. They've been very popular and they're, again, profitable. And so we're going to try to expand them across the country.
There's a big crowd inside the building today. Thank you so much for being with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Do I agree with everything Brian Welch or any of my guests say? Radio EcoShock is not a puppet show where guests express my own personal state of mind. It is a platform. It is your platform, supported by you, the listener, to hear the visionary voices, the real people who are doing it, before you make your own life choices. Thank you for listening and being part of Radio EcoShock. Find out how to support this program, please, at our website, ecoshock.org. And you can get tons of links for this show at our blog at ecoshock.info. I'm Alex Smith. If anything you hear makes you part of the solution, my job is done. Let's meet again next week. This is Vancouver's own Barney Bentall and the Legendary Heart.